activated moviegoers for a second straight weekend.
What's the plan?
Track him, find him, kill him.
Sylvester Stallone and his team of mostly 1980s action heroes earn an estimated $13.5 million in ticket sales. While August traditionally is slow for the movie industry, holdovers fill out the top five spots at the box office. That's a rarity. The Bourne Legacy is number two, followed by Paranorman, The Campaign, and The Dark Knight Rises. Of the weekend's new releases, Premium Rush opens in seventh place, and low-budget romantic comedy Hit and Run debuts in 10th. Horror film The Apparition finishes at number 12. Trina Williams, NPR News.
Dow's up 7 at 13,164. NASDAQ up 11, and the S&P 500 gaining 4. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from America's Natural Gas Alliance, supporting domestic energy while working to protect the environment. Learn more at anga.us.
Support for WILL comes from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods on the corner of 6th and University in Champaign, providing Champaign-Urbana with an international selection of chocolates, cheeses, oils, balsamic vinegar, jams, spices, barbecue sauces, and more. World Harvest invites you to join them in supporting public radio.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. It's hour two of the show. The following program comes from the Focus Archives, which means for the next hour, we will not be taking your calls.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. In this hour of Focus, we will be talking about the life of one of the most influential Americans of the 19th century, someone who in his day certainly was very well known, and yet today is not as well known as he should be. The man we're talking about is Frederick Law Olmsted. A lot of people will know that this was the man who designed Central Park in New York City. He designed a lot of other parks as well. He designed the Capitol grounds, the U.S. Capitol grounds in Washington, D.C. He's done the grounds of many university campuses. He also was involved in saving some wild places and really was a champion of places like Yosemite and Niagara Falls. And there was a lot more to him as well, as we will discover in this part of Focus as we talk with Justin Martin. He is the author of a newly published biography of Olmsted. The title of the book is Genius of Place. It is published by DeCapo. It's out now. Very interesting story, and he certainly was a fascinating man. So if you're interested in reading more, you can look for the book. Justin Martin is the author of two highly regarded biographies of rather different characters, certainly different than the man we're talking about this morning. He's written about both Alan Greenspan and Ralph Nader. And Justin Martin, hello.
Hello. How are you?
I'm fine. Thanks. And yourself?
Oh, very good. Thanks.
Good. Well, thanks very much for talking with us. I was really happy to have the opportunity to do this book. And again, I think I would have counted myself as one of those people who I think could have said Frederick Law Olmsted, oh, yeah, he was the man who designed Central Park. But past that, I probably couldn't have told you anything else. And I think it certainly is true that he is someone who people should know about. He certainly deserves to be remembered and as well known now as he was when he was working.
No, definitely. I agree. It's actually one of the things that led me to the project is, first of all, my own experience, similar to what you're describing, of you know, sort of saying, oh, yeah, Olmsted, he's the guy that designed Central Park. And then, you know, sort of gradually learning more about him and then learning that there was yet much more to learn about him and wanting to really dive into the project. And as you said, it's you know, he's a kind of titanic 19th century American figure who really has not appreciated at the level that he should be.
Yeah. And I think maybe in part, it's because at least some of the spaces that he designed seemed to be so natural. And I think people think this of Central Park particularly, but I'm sure there are others, that people thought, well, they just happened like that. They don't understand, they didn't realize that there, in fact, was a designer behind them.
That's a great observation. Now, what he very often did is he did parks inside of cities, and very often these were extremely unattractive pieces of land and didn't look particularly natural, or at least didn't look particularly lovely, and it often took a huge amount of design and interventions, I term it, to actually take a piece of land, often a very unattractive piece of land that the city had set aside hoping that Olmsted would turn it into a very beautiful park. It often took a lot of work, and Central Park's a great example. He used more gunpowder in Central Park blowing things up to prepare it for his design than was used at the Battle of Gettysburg.
Now, that's really remarkable. One, you just would have to imagine what Central Park, what that area of New York was like. It was where the city managed to concentrate an awful lot of undesirable qualities, and it certainly was something that the place now was definitely made, and it was the result of a lot of work and a lot of vision to get it to the point where it looks like it was just always there.
That's absolutely right. No, it was in that era, Manhattan, at least sort of developed Manhattan, extended about to where the Empire State Building is, and that's 34th Street. And above that was sort of countryside or hinterland, and it was a place where if you were doing something they didn't want you to be doing in the city proper, they told you to go up there. There were what were called nuisance industries, and these were very kind of grim Dickensian industries like tanning or bone boiling that produced various. Bone boiling was a kind of a very noxious way to make glue that involved boiling animal bones, and as you might imagine, it produced unpleasant smells and so forth. So if you were a bone boiler, they said, go up to this ugly piece of land, do your bone boiling there. The same goes for people who wanted to raise chickens and pigs and so forth. They also had concentrated on this very unattractive piece of land. They were raising their livestock.
Yeah. The another aspect, maybe one of the big aspects that I think it makes his life and achievement so remarkable is that he gets the credit for being America's first landscape architect. Some people would say maybe the greatest. I think he actually gets credit for coining the term. But at that time, you couldn't go to school and get a degree in landscape architecture. It seems that the things that he learned to do this from living.
That's absolutely right. You know, he's a great example of someone you might call it. He got a classic liberal arts education, is the way you might put it. He got it outside of the realm of school, too. He wasn't a particularly good student, and so he didn't get a lot of formal schooling. And he basically tried out a whole lot of different professions, everything from being a surveyor to being a sailor to being a farmer. And he took all the experience he gained from these earlier vocations that he kind of tried out. And when he became a park maker, he had a lot of experience and a lot of ideas to draw on. And he really brought a kind of multidisciplinary approach that maybe wouldn't have been possible if there had been landscape architecture as a profession. If he'd been able to go to landscape architecture school and get a degree, perhaps he wouldn't be drawing on as many disciplines as he was, given his own sort of scattershot education.
Yeah. So at least he did have this experience farming. I don't know if he was a particularly successful farmer, but he did have some experience working land and working with growing things. But it seems that a lot of the rest was, you know, what he learned was just by spending a lot of time outside. He spent a lot of time walking through Britain. And we'll talk about his writing about the South, but certainly mm-hmm. spent a lot of time traveling around. So it must be that he was always looking at things and soaking up the natural atmosphere of the places where he went.
Very true, and the walking tour of Britain that you allude to is a very formative experience for him. It's a great example of the way his mind worked even before he was a park maker. While he was in Britain, he had the opportunity to visit some parks that he was quite amazed by, and he kind of tucked away some of the details for future use. Who knows what? He wasn't a park maker yet. He also visited the grounds of a castle, and while he was there, he had this very American epiphany. Probably a lot of American travelers have had this same epiphany when visiting Britain. At first, he was really kind of delighted that he'd been able to pull some strings and enter the private grounds of this castle. And then the very next moment, as he recounts in a diary entry, he experienced a swing where he thought, what is this piece of land that's really set aside for the elite few and it's cloistered and behind fences? And he thought, that's so very undemocratic, so very unegalitarian, so very un-American. So he had this intense perception that certainly would later inform his park making. Mm.
Well, again, that brings us back to Central Park. We'll maybe tell some more of the story later, but maybe the big thing that separated his vision of the park from the others, and they had a competition, so they had, I think, more than 30 designs.
Mm-hmm.
The other people had in mind this kind of very formal, sort of heroic kind of thing that would have fountains and arches and broad, straight thoroughfares. And he said, no, that's not what this place should be. It should be a more natural place. But the reason was that he felt that people would be put off. They would feel small in mm-hmm. that kind of place. And that what he wanted was something that would be, that anyone, no matter what their social class and social standing was a kind of a place where anyone could feel at home.
That's absolutely right. Olmsted developed, certainly with Central Park, its first project, and over time developed what might be called a naturalistic aesthetic. And it was in stark contrast to, as you described, there was this design competition, and you had 33 contestants, and you had 32, most of the other 32 came in with what I describe as imperial parks. They had, just as you said, grand archways and so forth. And Olmsted felt that, you know, you walk under a grand archway, and for most people, it's a reminder of your small station life, some great, you know, this is to celebrate some great leader, some great military hero or whatever, and it's a constant reminder of one's small station. Whereas a natural park, where you're just walking among trees and lakes and so forth, it belongs to everyone. I mean, nature, no, Olmsted had the very distinct and, I guess, accurate perception that nature belongs to everyone, so a naturalistic park would be welcoming to people of all backgrounds.
Hmm. He apparently also had this feeling that there was this very strong connection between the landscape and human society, in the sense that one reflected the other, and that maybe he had this idea that unhealthy is the right word. A sort of an unhealthy landscape could produce an unhealthy society, or maybe it was the other way around. But that, by the same token, you know, a healthy landscape can help contribute to a healthy society.
Very much so. During his scattershot education, he did a lot of reading and a lot of reading on landscape theory. He also had a reverend he knew growing up who, it wasn't his family reverend, he was considered a little bit radical, too radical for the Olmsted family, but he had a concept, this reverend, that was known as unconscious influence, and the idea was that your environment could act upon you. And Olmsted took this notion and really ran with it. And for a lot of his designs, whether they were park designs, with park designs, he was really often thinking of ways where people might, you know, they might get respite from the teeming city. They might really, you know, find some peace and some remove, maybe be exposed to some beauty. And it would really act on them, as you described, psychologically. I should mention here, too, that Olmsted was, he loved designing mental institutions, designing their grounds. And part of the reason for this was because this was an incredible opportunity to create a landscape that was literally therapeutic, a landscape that if it was designed correctly, and he did about a half dozen mental institutions during his career, if it was designed correctly, it would actually, you know, help the patients that were in the institution.
Yeah, that's and oddly, ironically, it ends up at the end of his life when he is suffering from dementia and had needed to be in an institution. He actually was in an institution that he helped design, that he had designed the grounds for.
That's correct. Yeah, he at the end of his life, he was confined to McLean Asylum. He was suffering probably from, you know, it wasn't diagnosed, but some kind of senile dementia, perhaps it was Alzheimer's disease. And he'd many years earlier come up with a very intricate plan for McLean's grounds. And reportedly, when he was checked into McLean, he said among his last reported words, which were, "Confound them, they did not follow my plan."
Even then, he was still conscious of what he had wanted and that it wasn't quite what he had in mind.
Very true. No, even at the end, a frustrated artist, even at the end.
Yeah. Our guest in this hour is Justin Martin. He's the author of a new biography of Frederick Law Olmsted, Genius of Place. Is the title of the book. It's published by DeCapo Press, out in the bookstores now. And again, questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Maybe, again, let's pull back and maybe we could talk some more. You could talk some more about formative influences. You maybe talked about one that could contribute to this idea he had about this relationship between people and their well-being and the places where they lived. What other things do you think were really important to contributing to what he would then eventually do?
I think one of the most important things was his family, for lack of a better way of putting it, his father was a pretty poorly educated man, and his mother-in-law was as well when his father remarried. And Olmsted, but they had a deep appreciation for nature. That was really the place where they poured their passion. And so Olmsted would go on what his father described, loitering journeys through the Connecticut countryside. And these were, I love sort of picturing this. They were apparently just hushed. It was kind of, these were conducted on horseback, and little Olmsted would ride on a pillow that was set in front of his father's saddle on the horse. And it would be, these would be conducted in hushed reverence. You know, there would be very little speaking, but there was a sense that they were experiencing the landscape. And that was really, as I said, his father was not a bookish man. He was not a man who was given to or interested in book learning, but he was very, very passionate about the natural world. And so he really, I think he deeply imbued Olmsted with a passion for landscape with these what were called loitering journeys.
Yeah, and he certainly had the opportunity, and I don't know if the word you would apply to his father was indulgent, but certainly his father, as Frederick tried to figure out what he wanted to do with his life, his father was pretty patient with that.
His father sure was. I've kind of come to the conclusion that people obviously don't get to pick their parents, but had Olmsted picked a father, I don't think he could have or would have picked a better one. By 19th century standards and even by 21st century standards, his father was very warm and caring and also indulgent. I think that Olmsted wouldn't have necessarily performed or handled life very well under a strict regime. And so the fact that his father, you know, was kind of indulgent both with affection, with allowing Olmsted to take the time he needed to pursue various often speculative schemes, and also willing to even bankroll some of these schemes. I think Olmsted, I think he benefited from it. I'm not sure he's the kind of person who would have benefited from his father suddenly drawing a hard line saying you have to get serious, you have to pick a lane.
Yeah. He certainly had in his life his share of sadness, and I think that really reminds us of what life before the 20th century really was like, where women died in childbirth or otherwise they died young. Many children were born and they didn't live to adulthood. There was all kinds of disease that nothing could be done about.
Mm-hmm.
And so life was could be very tenuous, even for people of means. And him, for example, Olmsted lost his mother when he was only three, ended up losing others that were close to him. He lost some of his children. So you would have to, that certainly would have to have an effect on the way people thought and felt about life and the world and their place in it.
I'm certain it did. And in Olmsted's case, and as you described, he experienced so much loss. And we've come to think of the past as a time when there was more loss and also more, I guess, risk. People succumbed to diseases, and now there are cures for people, as you said, lost children, lost parents when the parents were young, and so forth. Even by those standards, Olmsted suffered way more loss than your average 19th century person. And I came to the conclusion, it's certainly obvious from his letters, his correspondence, that he felt like these parks, this park work, in part at least what was driving him, what was making him so intense and so passionate about the park work, was surrounded with so much evidence of life's fleetingness. He was very, very eager to create things of beauty that would be lasting, that would last beyond this very temporal world that he had a very, very good idea of.
Mm-hmm. And he certainly does seem to be somebody who could be very, very driven when he was working on a project. And I'm sure that made him a difficult man to be around.
He was. It's interesting because I think there's been sometimes the misperception that Olmsted was kind of a sort of a beatific figure, and I think that's kind of a conflating of his pastoral creations with his personality. And the fact is, he's like a lot of great artists. He was, he was in the service of creating great beauty. He was a pretty hard-bitten, hard-driving man, and he had trouble with everybody from his own sons who were to succeed him in the landscape architecture practice to partners like Vaux, with whom he broke up as a landscape architect partner, to various other people, to clients. I mean, just along the way, he had a vivid idea of what he wanted to achieve as an artist, and he had trouble working with people who he either didn't see eye to eye with, or he perceived as not having the same level of commitment or talent or whatever it might be. So he was a tough customer.
Yeah, he was really hard on his sons, at least in his assessment of their ability professionally. Now, they certainly carried on the Olmsted name and did all kinds of work, but it seemed that he was one of these guys who would, after all of that, no matter what you did, would sort of look at you and say, well, really, I have to say, son, you really don't have any talent. I mean, he literally did that.
Yeah, he sure did. No, he was very tough, and he set up, I don't know if he set it up, but he wound up with you want to talk about a difficult family business dynamic. His stepson, what happened was he married his his brother's widow after his brother died and raised three of his brother's children as his own. He also had natural children. One of his stepsons, his eldest stepson, and one of his natural children, who he christened Frederick Law Olmsted Jr., were both in the business to succeed him. And what an incredible, stress-filled, complex dynamic to have a father having a stepson and a natural son who he had some different ideas. With his stepson, he felt, as you alluded to, he wrote this just brutal letter in which he assessed his stepson, who is not his natural offspring, as being not a man of genius and lacking, in his estimation, the artistic talent to make a go of it as a landscape architect. As you might imagine, his natural son, Frederick Law Olmsted Jr., didn't always fare so well in the bargain. He was simply the recipient of incredible pressure to, you know, be sort of the Frederick Law Olmsted, heir, and to show the same interest, even as a very young man, as an 18-year-old, if he didn't show passionate excitement about landscape architecture, if he got excited about a football game, a new sport in that area that he was actually interested in, then Olmsted would be weighing down hard on him, wanting to know why he wasn't thinking about, beautiful landscapes. So it's a tough dynamic, but as you also point out, interestingly enough, both of the son and the stepson continued on for many decades, all the way until the 1950s, doing all kinds of landscapes around the country. So they were very successful as the inheritors of the Olmsted firm.
Yeah, and just add another layer on this, going back to Olmsted himself. We talked about how driven he could be, and when he was in a project, how there would be nothing else. There also seems to be reason, though, to believe that he would be diagnosed with probably what we would now call bipolar disorder, because he would have these intense periods of work and energy, and then he also would have these intense deep depressions.
Definitely. Had Olmsted been around in the 21st century, he would have been handed a quick diagnosis, very possibly bipolar disorder, certainly what you described. I mean, he would work at a just almost inhuman pace. I mean, when I was researching the biography, I would sometimes see that the volume of activity coming off him was just, it was startling. You could almost feel it. It almost came to life, here 120 years on. I'd be reading these letters, and he'd be saying, I'm off to Milwaukee, and then I'm down to the Biltmore Estate, Nashville, and this, you could just feel the crackling energy. And this would be followed by just stuporous depressions. And these stuporous depressions, I could feel some of the sort of the energy from them too, because he would produce a smaller volume of correspondence, but his handwriting would become very kind of sloppy, and it felt like he was in a stupor. And that was even when he was writing letters. There were periods in which he left off, and one could only conclude from other contemporaneous letters that he was actually in where they're describing him as being in a sorry state or whatever, that he'd slipped into a depression. So I think that he would have probably been diagnosed with something like, having perhaps bipolar disorder. The interesting thing with him is he had the benefit of a 19th century convention where people were allowed, particularly people of some means, were allowed to have just full-on breakdowns, which he did, and to go off to, say, a sanitarium for a rest cure, and then to return to the world renewed. And so I think that also that rhythm really benefited Olmsted. It was kind of a more 19th. Today, somebody would be put on a medication, perhaps, that would regulate them or level everything out. In Olmsted's case, he would have these periods of stupors and activity where he might go off for a rest cure, and then he'd return to the world renewed and just go off like a slingshot and, be working on 10 park designs at once.
Yeah. There was somehow at that time, there was this notion that kind of personality went with being an artistic, creative, sensitive person.
Mm-hmm.
And although I think it was also a grace that was really only made available to people of the upper class.
You're so right. I mean, Olmsted had the benefit exactly. He had the benefit if it was somebody of a perceived different class or somebody in a different profession, perhaps they'd simply be viewed as a roustabout or they'd be viewed as having moral turpitude or something else. In Olmsted's case, it was the wages of his creative personality was very accepted. In fact, he would, can't tell you the number of times when doing research where I came across letters where he requested permission from his clients to go to a sanitarium, to go off to, go off to places that kind of have a glamorous feel, to go off to Saratoga, for instance, for a rest cure. And I thought about, in modern terms, I thought this would be the equivalent if I or someone else said to a boss, you know, can I take a couple weeks off and check into a mental institution, it would probably not be well received. But in his ear, it was simply viewed as, oh, Olmsted's going to give us a fantastic design. As part of that, this sensitive artist needs to go off and, you know, get his head straight. So very different times.
In this hour of focus, we're talking about the life of the great American landscape architect, really America's first landscape architect, Frederick Law Olmsted. Justin Martin is our guest. He's written a new biography of Olmsted. Genius of Place is the title. We have a caller here to talk with in Belgium. Let's go there. Line four. Hello.
Hello, and good morning. For years, I thought Olmsted also designed Golden Gate Park in San Francisco, but he did not. I think he might have been consulted on it, but he definitely did not design it. The question I have, though, is on the other side of the bay, on the hills above Berkeley, there's another very attractive, much smaller park, and I'd heard that he possibly designed that one. Do you know of that one? I can't remember the name of that park either.
I don't know of that one. It's possible, although he did not do a whole lot of California work. He, as you described, he's often miscredited for designing Golden Gate Park, but he did, just as you described, act in sort of a consulting role with William Hammond Hall, the man who actually designed it. He did, right about the end of the Civil War, he was out in California. He did a couple things, such as Mountain View Cemetery in Oakland. He did a failed plan for the campus of Berkeley that just a few sort of vestigial elements actually did get designed. But he didn't do a lot of California design work, and so I suspect his sons, who I was talking about earlier, they made their mark all over America, and they did a lot more West Coast work than Olmsted did. They did work, for instance, they designed the Seattle Park System. So it's very possible that the Olmsted firm came in afterwards and designed that park that you're alluding to.
Yeah, because the Berkeley campus goes up into the hills there, just east of Berkeley.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was called the Oak Lawn. Oakwood. It was called Oakwood because there's a huge oak forest that encompassed that whole portion of the East Bay there. And maybe that's what it was. He was talked a little bit to Berkeley and maybe just a few vestiges things.
It's possible. It's possible it's one of those. The other possibility is that his sons came in and designed it. And an interesting little side note is Frederick Law Olmsted Jr. dropped the junior. And so professionally, it appears. Now, Central Park was designed in 1858.
Yeah.
Frederick Law Olmsted Jr. retired in 1958, 100 years later. But because he dropped the junior professionally, there are parks all over the country which were designed by Frederick Law Olmsted in the 20th century. But you know right off the bat, since Olmsted Sr. died in 1903, that these must have been done by the son.
I see. So
yep.
That might be what the deal is, too.
Could well be.
Thank you very much.
Absolutely. Nice talking to you.
That's interesting. Between father and sons, they did an enormous number of university campuses.
They sure did. Yeah, university campuses were sort of they're a good venue for design because they're very organic. They're never really complete. There's always additions to be done. I mean, one of Olmsted's most notable projects was he really got in on Stanford, which was considered one of his best designs really at its inception. But most universities, like say Yale, which he did some work on, those universities had already existed for many years, and over the subsequent years, yet more new buildings would be designed and so forth. So he did a lot. He and his sons did a lot of campus work because it was just constantly a call to, you know, we need to expand our campus. We need to build a new satellite campus. I mean, there were just always opportunities to. And, of course, there was always a desire for these campuses to have sort of park-like attributes.
We're talking in this hour with Justin Martin. We're talking about the life of America's great first landscape architect. Some people would say America's greatest, Frederick Law Olmsted. He writes about this in his book, Genius of Place. We'll talk some more after a short break. This is Focus.
Hi, I'm Kevin Kelly, host of Live and Local on FM 90.9. Starting September 4th, the show will move to a new time at 4 o'clock weekdays, just before All Things Considered. We'll also begin to add recordings by local artists to our regular mix of interviews and live music. If you're a musician in any acoustic genre working anywhere in our listening area, please send your CDs to me at 300 North Goodwin Avenue, Urbana, Illinois, 61801. Thanks, and thanks for listening.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of a previous Focus program. As this conversation is pre-recorded, we're not taking phone calls today. This is Focus.
In this hour, Justin Martin is our guest. He's the author of a new biography of Frederick Law Olmsted, Genius of Place. It's published by DeCapo. He's also written biographies of Alan Greenspan and Ralph Nader. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We've talked a lot about Olmsted as a landscape architect. There is certainly more. It's amazing that that should be enough, but there's a lot more to his life. And I want to talk about some other aspects. He worked, among other things, he worked as a journalist and worked for the New York Times when it was new. And they sent him to the South, and this was in the time before the Civil War. They sent him to the South to travel around the South and to write about what he saw. How did he end up getting a job at the New York Times?
Well, while working as a farmer, he had a neighbor who was a kind of a weekend hobby farmer named George Putnam. Putnam is a name that has some resonance to this day because Putnam was a publishing magnate, and his publishing company still exists. And so while Olmsted was a farmer, he took a walking tour across England, and Putnam asked Olmsted if he would like to produce a book for Putnam's, and he produced a book called Walks and Talks of an American Farmer in England. It was met with tepid reviews, very modest sales, but it did set him up as a journalist. And then when the brand-new New York Times was looking for someone to send across the South, they weighed two factors. Olmsted had a five-minute interview with Henry Raymond, the editor of the Times, and he had a writing credit. This book he'd written, Walks and Talks of an American Farmer, and Olmsted was a farmer himself, and actually that was appealing to Raymond, the editor, because the South in that era was nothing if not an agrarian society. And so sending a farmer who could write to cover the South was ideal.
He personally, when he went into this, he did think slavery was not good, and that eventually slavery should go away. He wasn't exactly a militant or fervent abolitionist. How would you describe his feelings about slavery, at least at the start of this project?
Sure. Actually, the editor, Henry Raymond, that's kind of maybe what you might describe a third qualification that Raymond was looking for. Is he was looking for someone who wasn't a fervent abolitionist. He wanted the brand new Times, kind of as the paper has continued to this day, wanted a kind of a balanced approach to the reporting, as opposed to someone who's more polemical. And so Olmsted, at this point, was what was called a gradualist, and that was appealing to the editor because a gradualist was someone who believed that, as you described, that slavery was wrong, but at the same time thought that, you know, it was going to take time before this institution could kind of be unwound. I mean, many of the founding fathers, such as Jefferson, would have said as much. They would have said slavery is wrong, but it's going to take time to, given that the economy is so dependent on it, it's going to take time to unwind this institution. And furthermore, Olmsted, as a Northerner, believed, per the sort of classic federal issues, that the North certainly had no right to impose its views on the South, that the South would have to make these decisions in its own good time. So in a way, he was a very excellent candidate to go down and do this reporting in the South. And what was fascinating was Olmsted went down, saw the institution of slavery, reported on it in a very clear-eyed way, and ultimately he made the transition based on all he observed from being a gradualist to being a abolitionist.
Yeah. This is another way where he certainly is important, because his writing about slavery, which not only was published in the paper, but then that was gathered together and is actually published as a book, was turned out to be quite influential in getting people to think about slavery, not only in the United States, but also in Britain as well.
Yeah, he actually published a collection of his Southern dispatches were put together in a book called The Cotton Kingdom, and also sort of updated and some sort of other material added to make it have the flow of a narrative. And then that book, which was published in 1861, right when Olmsted started working on it right before the first shots at Fort Sumter, and by the time it was published in England, that was the first place it was published, the Civil War had broken out. And England was actually on the fence. They were on the fence about whether to join with the Confederacy or with the Union. And Olmsted's book was read by incredibly influential members of English society. Darwin, Dickens, Karl Marx, who was living in London at that point, read The Cotton Kingdom. And it really, he helped, Olmsted sort of entered into the public debate, as it were. And you certainly couldn't give him anything like full or even a huge amount of credit for swaying English public opinion towards the Union versus the Confederacy. But he certainly, this book certainly played a role, since it reached these real opinion leaders in English society.
Yeah, and it's still in print.
This book was published in 1861. It is still in print. You can find it at a library. You can find it on Amazon.com. And the number of people who have found it a useful resource. A window into the antebellum South is remarkable. I'll just mention a couple. Charles Dickens, who spent all this time doing lecture tours during the 19th century through America, said that it was a very accurate account of the South as he'd seen it. And then Malcolm X, while in prison, as many people might know, Malcolm X kind of self-educated himself in prison. And one of the books that he read that he credited with giving him a real kind of unvarnished view of slavery was Olmsted's The Cotton Kingdom. So it's a highly influential book that's stayed in print for 150 years.
So Olmsted traveled around. He talked to as many people as he could. He tried, and indeed, he talked to slaves where he was allowed to do that. So, you know, one might ask, well, the people who ran the plantations weren't really going to show him the dark underside of slavery. He wasn't going to be able to see the worst. Was he able, do you think, did he feel that he was really able to see what he needed to see to write the stories that he wanted to write?
He was, ultimately, for a couple reasons. Every now and then he got these great opportunities. For instance, one time a slave was assigned to take Olmsted to his next plantation, so to convey him in a coach. And Olmsted has this wonderful description where he was bursting with questions for this slave, for this man, and he had to kind of stop himself because he knew that if he just started blurting all the questions he built up, that the man would kind of become suspicious or he'd be put off. So Olmsted very casually, you know, started out with the kind of questions you'd ask a new acquaintance and worked its way slowly to some sort of blockbusters. And in the course of this particular, one-on-one with this slave, he really, he was able to get some of his questions answered. He also had many opportunities where even though there were masters present or foremen present, he was just able to observe the institution of slavery and also observe how there were certain absurd things that the masters treated almost as if they were just normal. And so we're not uncomfortable revealing these to Olmsted. And then ultimately, Olmsted had an incredibly an episode that he experienced where a foreman got very comfortable in Olmsted's presence and did the thing which Olmsted certainly had heard tell of but had not had the opportunity to witness. He actually punished a slave in front of Olmsted. He whipped a young woman brutally. And this particular event was just searing for Olmsted. I mean, Olmsted felt complicit because he didn't feel like he could tell the foreman not to do this. He felt like it was terribly morally wrong. And Olmsted was on a horse in a gully at the time this happened, and the horse flared its nostrils and ran up out of the gully. And Olmsted, who was very attuned to nature, took this as a sign that there was something deeply unnatural about this brutal act. And this was one of the main events that really caused Olmsted to make this transition from being a gradualist to being a abolitionist. And in fact, he took this episode, the whipping of a slave, a young slave woman whose name was Sal, and he positioned it in the book The Cotton Kingdom, so it's kind of the dramatic climax of the narrative.
Yeah. Our guest in this hour of Focus, Justin Martin, I just want to mention here, we're talking about the life of Frederick Law Olmsted. He writes about this in his book Genius of Place, which is just recently out. If you would like to take a look at it, he's a really remarkable character, and as we said in the beginning, deserves to be better known. We have about 10, 12 minutes left in this part of the show. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Yet another remarkable facet of this life occurs during the Civil War. He directed something called the U.S. Sanitary Commission, which was involved in trying to organize medical care for wounded soldiers, and I guess just generally was interested in trying to do what it could to promote the health of soldiers, which was really a serious issue. One of the amazing statistics about the war is I think more people died as a result of disease in the army than died as a result of being killed or wounded. So conditions for soldiers, just basic living conditions, could be really, really bad.
Yeah, it was real interesting. He headed up this outfit that you described, and it was really in an era when there was a notion almost that privation for the soldiers was kind of the right state to make them a lean, mean fighting machine. And so considerations like hygiene, diet, medicine for disease, generals and army officials almost took it as a sign, almost you were sort of weak or soft if you were thinking about that. What you wanted to do is you wanted to have a great strategy, a great on-paper strategy, and then you wanted to have the fighting force executed in lockstep and with precision, and that was how battles were to be fought. And if people died of disease or didn't have proper nutrition or whatever it might be, that wasn't the concern. And Olmsted actually entered into this very fray, and he made a kind of a very counterintuitive 19th century, in 19th century terms, argument that actually a battle might be won or lost due to lack of nourishment, due to people being diseased, due to them not having had proper sleep in the days leading up to the battle. It was a tough case to make. Olmsted did everything he could to prevail on you know, the 19th century military establishment. And certainly one thing he was able to do is his outfit was charged with providing relief for people, not the battlefield wounded necessarily, but people who'd taken ill during battle or people that were malnourished. They often fell to Olmsted's outfit to treat them. And so he was able to provide a huge amount, a really incalculable battlefield relief during some of the major Civil War battles, such as Antietam and Gettysburg. Mm.
So how did he end up getting that job? It seemed, again, one of these things that given what he had done, seemed to be unlikely.
Very unlikely. Well, the United States Sanitary Commission was the brainchild of a man named Henry Bellows, a very well-known reverend in New York City. And as it happens, Henry Bellows was a writer on the side. He wrote for The Atlantic magazine, and he'd written an article about Central Park. And in writing the article about Central Park, and he'd had the opportunity to meet with Olmsted, and had become convinced that Olmsted was a very able administrator. And in a different era, you know, when it was sort of you know, in the 19th century, it was more of a sort of all hands on, you know, if you volunteer for something, it was kind of all hands on deck. In this case, the Civil War had just broken out, so there was a desperate need for just people who might seem like they could fit into various needs, fill various needs. And in Olmsted's case, he proved himself a brilliant administrator with the design and construction of Central Park. And so Civil War breaks out. Bellows, who's you know, brainchild of the United States Sanitary Commission, is, thinks, well, not a whole lot of correspondence between designing and executing a park and running a medical relief outfit, a battlefield medical relief outfit. But, you know, there wasn't much time to sort of do a huge candidate search or what have you. And so Olmsted was tapped for this very different but job, but one that he proved incredibly able.
Yeah. Well, that's it. Going back to Central Park, I think what people really should appreciate is that Olmsted was a very much hands-on kind of guy. He wasn't not simply someone who was sitting in a studio somewhere doing things on paper. When, in fact, before he got the job of actually doing the design, when he entered the design competition, he was the superintendent there at what was at that time the park. So he was doing infrastructure and prep work to try to get ready to be a park, which involved a lot of physical labor in being there on the site. And so he really was kind of a civil engineer. I think maybe it might be fair to say that. So that was really what he was doing. So he had this remarkable vision, but he was also a guy who had his hands in the dirt.
Very much so. He was part of his brilliance, part of why so many of his park plans were executed, and part of why so many of them exist to this day is he was not, just as you described, he was not just an artist and a designer. He also had become deeply involved in the actual creation of these parks, and often that involved all kinds of skills such as drainage engineering and also sort of administrative skills. He was, for quite a while, he was sort of the superintendent of Central Park as it was being designed. And he had all kinds of ideas, like he had signs he put up to say, you know, stay off the grass, don't throw missiles, as he put it, at birds. He also even came up, he thought about a lot of different sort of administrative things. For instance, he wanted to come up with spaces for carriages, places where people could park them. And there was no word. There was no word for what this was. So he came up with the term carriage rest. But what he'd really come up with was a concept which we've been introduced to, I guess, in the 20th century through urban planners, which was the parking space. So Olmsted was deeply involved in trying to figure out things like the flow through the parks and so forth, and how to, you know, how to administer them in various ways. And so he was very able in this regard, and it made him someone who, when he applied that same skill to something very different, setting up a battlefield relief outfit, he was immensely skilled at it.
All right, let's talk with, we have another caller here we'll talk with, in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I came in late, so you might have covered this. Am I correct that Olmsted had designed the Columbian Exposition in 1893 in Chicago?
You bet, and you didn't come in late. It's actually, we didn't talk about it, and it's properly thought of as Olmsted had sort of twin swan songs. He had two incredible projects at the end of his life that he was doing concurrently. One of them was the Biltmore Estate. There was a giant house in Asheville, North Carolina, a giant mansion in Asheville, North Carolina, that he did for George Vanderbilt. And the other was this incredible project, the Columbian Exposition for Chicago, where he designed the grounds for this World's Fair that was really going to be a world stage test of Chicago and also of the United States. If there are going to be people visiting from all over the world, it would be a world stage test of you know, how proficient America was in technology and arts and other things. And he came up with just a tour de force design that really made the White City, as it came to be known, as a very memorable experience for the millions of visitors.
Yes, and am I also right in terms of transportation? He developed the what we now know as the L in Chicago, of getting people to the fair by rail as opposed to other transportation.
Yeah, what he did there is he didn't really develop in any sense. He picked a spot that was 7 miles from downtown Chicago. He thought this was the spot that the fair should be, because he thought that Lake Michigan would provide a striking natural backdrop, which he thought was very important for this fair. It had to have something stunning as its backdrop. And as it happened, there was a rail line that passed close to these grounds. And so Olmsted made the point that, yes, this was 7 miles outside of what was then downtown Chicago, but it would be easy enough to convey the thousands and thousands of people who would travel on a daily basis to this fair. It would be possible to convey them by the existing rail line.
Yeah, and I suppose the tenor of the time, what was very interesting, and the photographs I've seen of Olmsted, he's always quite dressed, and the pictures that I've seen of the Columbian Exposition, the fairgoers tend to wear suits and ties and hats and so forth, and the women were in long dresses.
Yeah, no, it would have been hot. It would have been hot, I guess. Also, I haven't seen anything in any of Olmsted's letters, but perhaps he also was thinking about the fact that, you know, Lake Michigan as the backdrop would give you some breeze on a hot summer day when people dressed very differently, as you point out, than they do today.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. Well, we have about 5 minutes left. One thing, another area I want to at least have you touch on, which is as important, I think, as his designing of these natural spaces, some of them in urban environments. He was also really a champion of wild spaces and felt very strongly that wilderness, wild places should stay that way. And this was at a time when I'm sure that there were people who were making the argument that said, well, these places should be developed.
No, very true. Olmsted, because he traveled just a huge amount for his various park commissions, he was constantly on the road, constantly traveling by train, by stagecoach, and out the window of these various forms of conveyance, he began to notice that this kind of American myth was under siege, this notion that America was just a limitless land that was, you know, was indestructible. He began to see, you know, out the window while he was going to work on his various park commissions, that there were natural places where there were big timber, was already clear-cutting woods, there was, you know, mountainsides were being mined. And so he became very aware that these natural places were under siege. And so wearing a kind of different hat, one hat he had was park maker in urban settings, such as New York or Chicago. Another hat he began to wear was a person who was calling for 19th century efforts at conservation and making this kind of clarion call that these spaces were under siege and that if the right steps weren't taken, perhaps they'd be lost forever. He was really the main person making early calls for the preservation of Yosemite. He also was really the primary 19th century person to make calls for the preservation of Niagara Falls. And, you know, he did this basically by, you know, what he would do is he would connect with various, because he had this experience as a journalist, he'd connect with various journalists and he'd argue his case to them and they'd sort of disseminate the word out. And so in this way, he was able to kind of do a public information campaign on the need to conserve and preserve natural spaces.
Yeah. Again, I realize we're kind of jumping around, but one thing I do at least want to touch on, because it's something that's here in Illinois, what is, I guess, thought to be the first planned community ever in the United States. I'm not sure about that designation, but at least I've seen it referred to that way. It's Riverside, Illinois.
Yeah, Riverside is striking. It's I was actually in Chicago last week, and I visited Riverside again. It's just, as you described, it's designed at a time when the notion of the suburb, and there were really very few suburbs, and where there were suburbs, they didn't tend to be done with any great design acumen. And Olmsted really, it's become a cliche at this point, the idea of the suburb being a kind of mix of the best attributes of a city and the best attributes of the country. But that was really what Olmsted conceived of when he designed the suburb. And so, you know, it had abundant communal space, had nice winding roads. At the same time, people had nice big lots, unlike they would have had in downtown Chicago. And so it's really a brilliantly designed suburb that, and the design is so brilliant that you can visit today, and it's still a very attractive place to live and attract, you know, an easy commute into Chicago. And it's, over the years, it's proved, Olmsted's design has proved to be a kind of blank canvas, or you might say a lovely canvas, on which a lot of notable architects, such as Frank Lloyd Wright, who worked much later than Olmsted, was alive, have designed houses in Riverside to go on his landscape design.
Yeah, it's one of those, it's a place that has the qualities that we now talk about, wanting to have places where people can gather, places where people can have a little bit more peace. He thought it was important for there to be green spaces scattered throughout, and to have kind of winding, natural feeling roads, and all of those things that now we say, if you were going to design a community from the ground up, that's what you want to have.
Absolutely. No, it's you can fairly say that any modern suburb that's nicely designed is taking a page from Olmsted's original 1868 design, and a lot of it was, per what we were talking about at the very beginning, I mean, Olmsted really wanted to create a place. He had a sense so many cities in that era, and Chicago certainly fell into that category, had a rigid, angular gridwork of streets, and that communicated, and things were very dense, and that communicated a kind of frenzy. And so here, the suburb that Olmsted designed, it was designed to go against that angularity. It was designed to have, you know, sort of flowing, curving streets, abundant green space, houses that varied one from another architecturally, and all of that would literally decompress people. They'd come in by train in that era from Chicago, and they'd come home to a place where they just had a different vibe that was informing their life. As I said, it's a masterful suburban design that continues to be a model that people follow, that urban planners follow to this day. Mm.
Well, we're at the point where we're going to have to stop. I'm just really pleased to have the opportunity to learn about this man and all of the remarkable things that he did. And I guess I'm still, at the end, though, sort of interested in this contrast between the spaces that he made and how people feel, and the fact that he himself, aside from the fact that in later life you see photographs of him and he seems to be this very grandfatherly kind of figure, mm-hmm. was a very fierce and very driven man. And that it seems interesting to try and reconcile that aspect of his character with these places that he made.
Yeah, I guess it's like so many things, it's kind of hard to reconcile. I guess the conclusion I drew is he was like so many great artists, he was driven to create beauty. And, I mean, he wanted, and I think in some ways he's driven to create beauty because he wanted to create environments that provided peace and remove that he didn't have in his own life. I mean, I think part of what really kind of drove him is he didn't lead a peaceful life. He had a lot of things driving him, a lot of things that he was anxious about. He dealt with a lot of loss. And so he wanted to create spaces that would, I guess, create the peace that he was so lacking in his own life.
Yeah. Well, for folks who would like to read more about the life of Frederick Law Olmsted, the book to look for is Genius of Place. It's just recently been published by Tekapo Press, by our guest Justin Martin. And thanks very much for talking with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. Much of our local production, including past interviews from Focus and local news features, is available on our website anytime you want to listen at will.illinois.edu.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Subaru of Champaign County, featuring the Subaru Impreza, with standard all-wheel drive and an EPA highway rating of 36 mpg, depending on conditions. More information is available at SubaruofChampaign.com or at their location on Route 45 in Savoy.
On tomorrow's Focus, a conversation with Harvard Law Professor Mark Tushnet, author of Why the Constitution Matters. Then in the 11 o'clock hour of the program, award-winning author John Himmelman's the guest, author of Cricket Radio, Tuning in the Night Singing Insects. couple of more programs from the archives tomorrow. And a reminder that we'll be back with live shows starting next Tuesday. Of course, Labor Day Monday, then back with live shows Tuesday at 10 a.m. A week from tomorrow here on Focus. And coming up next, the Afternoon Magazine here on listener-supported public radio, WILL AM 580. I'm Craig Cohen. Among the stories we're following at this hour, Champaign Mayor Don Girard is pleased with Governor Quinn's veto of a bill setting up a statewide recycling program for plastic bags. We'll tell you about that. Also, why an inmate in the restricted unit at the federal prison in Terre Haute, Indiana, is headed to court seeking to convince a judge the government's trampling on his religious rights. Those are just a couple of the stories we're following, and we'll tell you about that and a whole lot more news from NPR, the BBC, and Illinois Public Media coming up in the next hour on the Afternoon Magazine. Let's update you now on what's happening in the commodity markets, starting with Kansas City wheat for September, trading at 8.76, down a quarter. December wheat at 9.01, also down a quarter. Chicago wheat for September is at 8.67 and three quarters.